It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics, including the first visit by a sitting president to a federal prison tomorrow.
First, the Food and Drug Administration is moving to strengthen safety warnings on widely used over-the-counter and prescription painkillers, ones you've most likely taken at some point, maybe recently.
At issue here are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs. We're talking about things like ibuprofen, Advil, and Aleve. So what exactly is changing, and does this mean you should stop taking these medications?
Bruce Lambert joins us now. He's the director of the Center for Communication and Health at Northwestern University. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob.
So new safety labels on these very common over-the-counter pain remedies. What will these new warnings say to us?
What we're really going to see are strengthened warnings. There are already warnings on these medicines that they increase the risk of heart attack and stroke and stomach bleeding and heart failure. So they're basically going to strengthen these warnings. And these are for these very commonly used drugs that you mentioned, drugs like Aleve or Motrin or Advil or prescription drug Celebrex. So there's new evidence that these risks are somewhat greater than we thought before and affect a larger number of people than we thought before. So the FDA is asking the manufacturers or instructing the manufacturers to strengthen these warnings.
So how does our behavior change here, I think, is the big question most people are asking. Does that mean, gosh, I should not take these medicines anymore? I should raise the bar for when I use them? What are we looking at there?
Right. I think that the general advice that the FDA is giving and that physicians are giving to their patients is that you should use these medicines as little as possible, at the lowest dose possible, for the shortest time possible. That there doesn't seem to be a completely safe dose, that is a dose at which there's no risk, and there doesn't seem to be a completely safe duration, that is a period of time at which there's no risk. So these risks of heart attack and stroke and heart failure can happen relatively soon after you start taking them, and even at relatively low doses. But the risk definitely increases the longer you take them and the higher the dose that you take. So you want to take them for as short a period of time as you can, and at the lowest dose that you can. And if there are non-drug alternatives for dealing with your pain, which might be stretching or exercise or weight loss or meditation or physical therapy or surgery or acupuncture, there's all these ways that people can deal with pain other than with medicines, then people should consider those. Not all these drugs are completely identical. The FDA doesn't go very far in saying whether one is safer than another, but I've reviewed the scientific evidence, and the drug naproxen, which is known by several brand names like Aleve and Naprosyn, does seem generally to be safer than the others, but none of them are completely safe.
But those recommendations you gave, use them as little as possible, use them sparingly. I think I'll speak from personal experience. I've taken them a lot in my life, maybe when I didn't need to. The common practice, I think, is to treat these as not candy, but no more dangerous than candy, I think, for a lot of people.
Right. I think that's a mistake. I think we now have very strong evidence that these medicines have real risks. And they're risks for serious outcomes. They're not risks for mild, bad outcomes, but they're risks for things like heart attack and stroke, which are often fatal, and even when they're not fatal, they're permanently disabling. So I think it's a real mistake to think that these medicines, even though many of us have taken them, are completely safe. Now, they cause or increase the risk of really common outcomes. So about 800,000 people a year in the United States have a heart attack, and another 800,000 per year, roughly, have strokes. So these outcomes are so common, especially among older people, that we don't necessarily notice the increased risk that these medicines might be causing. But there's good scientific evidence that they are, in fact, sometimes doubling the risk of these bad outcomes.
Talking to Bruce Lambert, he's with Northwestern University's Center for Communication and Health, looking at new warnings coming out from the FDA on common pain relievers. I want to put this risk in context, Bruce. You said it's an increased risk, but compared to things like smoking and other risk factors for heart health and other issues, how does this add up? How does this compare?
Right. The risk associated with these medicines is smaller than the risk that you have if you smoke. So the biggest risks for heart disease and stroke are things like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, smoking, diabetes, being overweight, being inactive, drinking too much. These are the really big risk factors, and they can increase the risk of heart attack more than taking these medicines. But at the highest doses, some of these medicines are comparable in the size of the risk to some of these other well-known risk factors, like having diabetes, for example. And so one of the messages is, if you are relatively young or heart healthy, that is, you don't smoke, you don't have high blood pressure or high cholesterol, et cetera, then these drugs are relatively safer for you because your risk of heart disease compared to people who do smoke is much less. The same way that these drugs are safer, generally speaking, for younger people than they are for older people, because the risk of stroke and heart attack is greater for older people.
One pain reliever that I don't think is on this list of medications is aspirin. Does that mean that aspirin is safe, don't worry about it, or at least safer than ibuprofen and the other ones in this new warning?
I actually think that is the message. The FDA probably, could have mentioned this, in some of the things that the media might have mentioned this more. But in fact, aspirin is safer than these other drugs when it comes to the risk of heart attack and stroke. Aspirin is actually used in low doses to prevent heart attack, whereas these other medicines increase the risk of heart attack. So I think one of the messages here is that aspirin is a safe medicine for pain. The one thing that all of these medicines, including aspirin, but not including Tylenol or acetaminophen, have in common is that they increase the risk of stomach bleeding. And this is also a serious risk. So you can take aspirin and not be afraid of heart attack or stroke risk, but you do have to be worried if you've ever had a history of an ulcer or any stomach bleeding, because aspirin can still cause that.
And a lot of parents may be thinking, wait, they told us not to give aspirin to infants, to little kids. Still
this
true, right?
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. Aspirin is absolutely not to be used in children because of the risk of this condition called RISE syndrome. So you should not use aspirin in children. But in adults, aspirin really is a miracle drug in many ways. It reduces the risk of heart attack and reduces the risk of some cancers. And although it does have this risk of causing stomach bleeding, most studies show that the benefit is greater than the risk. And I should also say that Tylenol isn't mentioned in these warnings, or acetaminophen, the active ingredient in many, many, many cold and flu and pain-relieving medicines, does not increase the risk of heart attack or stroke. But acetaminophen or Tylenol has other risks. It's bad for your liver, especially if you take too much of it or if you combine it with alcohol. So one of the messages is that there's sort of no free lunch. None of these medicines are completely without risk, and you have to balance the risk in light of your own sort of risk for heart disease and so on, and in light of the benefit that you get. So, we wrote this article, it's online, and a lot of the commenters were saying that they depend on these medicines to sort of get along in their daily life. And if you're gaining a tremendous benefit from these medicines and are allowing you to function, to you it may be worth the risk. And that's a decision that individuals ought to make. No one's talking about banning these medicines or taking them off the market or making them only available by prescription, which they were only available by prescription for many years until the mid-90s when many of them became available over the counter.
And Bruce, before I let you go, a lot of people may be hearing this and thinking, okay, science says a product is bad for me. In a couple of weeks, they're going to say it's fine or even good for me. You don't think, as I understand it, that's going to happen with this one?
Right. That's really frustrating when we hear coffee is good for us, and the next week coffee is bad for us. And it's really frustrating, and people lose faith in these warnings. But I think in the case of these medicines, these nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, naproxen, Advil, Aleve, et cetera, we've known for a long time that since Vioxx was taken off the market in more than 10 years ago, we've known that these drugs were dangerous and that they increased the risk of stroke and heart attack. That has not changed. So I think it's extremely unlikely that we will ever hear a study like next week or next month or next year that, we were wrong, and these it's really safe to take Celebrex or not safe, but that they don't cause an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. I think we're as certain as we can be that these medicines do increase this risk, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That's Bruce Lambert. He's director of the Center for Communication and Health at Northwestern University. Joins us to talk about the latest news regarding stronger warnings on over-the-counter painkillers, things like ibuprofen, brand names like Advil. President Obama is having another big week. Yesterday, he announced a nuclear deal with Iran. Tomorrow, he plans to become the first sitting president to visit a federal prison. It's our weekly look now at the latest in national politics.
Also this week, Governor Walker is kicking off his campaign with a busy travel schedule to early primary states, and Hillary Clinton staking out her economic policy position against a backdrop of enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders' populist messages. Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, joins us every week at this time. Harry, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, a lot of news in the last day and a half or so about the Iran deal. And one of the takeaways from this, aside from the politics, is that this is a key cornerstone to the Obama legacy. How big a deal do you see it as being part of that legacy?
I mean, foreign policy, of course, is one of the big assets that, you know, a president has in terms of his legacy. You talk about foreign policy, you talk about the economy, and those tend to be the two biggest things. And, of course, Iran has been a major player in the Middle East for a long time coming now, you know, going all the way back to the Carter administration where you had the Shah overthrown, and Iran has sort of been an enemy of the United States since then. So if we were able to have a deal with them whereby we deterred them from developing a nuclear weapon, that would be a huge deal for President Obama to say, hey, look, I got us, you know, out of this recession. I dealt with that well, and then I killed Osama bin Laden. And now I've made a deal with Iran. It's a troika. It's a very big thing for him. So if they are able to get this deal through Congress, he will be able to say, I've done it. And going forward in the history books will say that I've done it. And I've done these three great things.
Now, it's been contentious in its, you know, baby form all along. But now that it's actually a deal that's been agreed upon, what kind of reaction are we seeing from the right and the left?
Well, the right has pretty much been in universal opposition to this. There, if you look at the presidential candidates, with the exception of Rand Paul, you know, who obviously is off in his own corner, and the libertarian right is off in its own corner, most of the Republican presidential candidates have been clearly against this. Jeb Bush, who is thought of to be more of a moderate among the Republican presidential candidates, called it pretty much appeasement. So they're all against this. When this vote goes for a vote in front of the Congress, it would be somewhat surprising if you didn't get at least 99% of both House Republicans and Senate Republicans to go against it. The left, the Democrats, it's a little more interesting. Hillary Clinton has come out for the deal, which to me suggests that it's going to be difficult to see too many Democrats come out against it. But there are certainly going to be some who do. Robert Menendez, who's a senator from New Jersey, a Democratic senator, has pretty much come out against it. But it should be that more than 75, 80, 90% of Democrats come out for the deal. So we're seeing a pretty usual partisan split on it.
And what about the American people? What do they think about it?
Well, you know, the American people obviously have only been thinking about this in the abstract of what they've heard. And, you know, deals like this are very detailed. And I don't think a regular news, you know, even a regular news listener really can quite comprehend what's going on. You know, these things are tons of pages long. But most of the people, when they at least they hear sort of the deal in the abstract, you know, a general summary of it, have been mostly in favor of it. A Fox News poll last month, I think, had it 47-43, with 47% in favor and 43 against. And what we saw in that polling is generally the same split that we would expect otherwise, with Democrats being mostly for it and Republicans being mostly against it.
Congress has 60 days to review this deal. And during that time, will we also be seeing appeals to the American people one way or the other?
Well, I think what you're going to see is that, you know, congressmen and congresswomen are going to be listening to the constituents and sort of hearing, you know, what's going on and whether they think it's politically smart for them to vote for it. So, of course, the president and his administration is going to try and sell it. But the thing that's going to be key going forward to remember is that in order for this deal to get derailed, you're going to need to see a veto-proof majority in each house of the Congress to say, no, we don't want this deal. As long as there isn't more, as long as there's less than two-thirds in each the Senate and the House saying that they are against this deal, as long as there's less than that, then the deal is going to pass.
How do you see it going?
Well, if we figure all the Republicans, you know, go against it, then President Obama needs most of the Democrats to go for it. And at this point, it does seem that most of the Democrats are going to go for it, but there are still enough Democrats out there who haven't said one way or another which way they're going to go. That is, you know, it makes for a little bit of excitement during this summer. I think the smart money is for the Congress ultimately not to be able to attain those veto-proof majorities, but we don't know yet. So we'll have to keep an eye on it.
We're talking national politics right now with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. And in other big news for the president, he's heading to Oklahoma tomorrow to become the first sitting president to visit a federal prison, trying to get attention around prison reform. Now, this is something he hasn't talked a lot about during his presidency. Why is he bringing this up now?
I think, you know, it's the next thing. It's, you know, this is a president who comes from, you know, urban Chicago, and this is a big thing among the Democratic base that, you know, there are a lot of African-Americans in the Democratic base, and African-Americans make up a much larger percentage of the prison population than they do of the overall population. But I think the other thing that's important here is that he has support among all the different sections of the American public. Independents, Democrats, and Republicans are all in favor of prison reform, thinking that, you know, we have people who are in prison far too long. We have these mandatory sentences that we force judges to apply to criminals who might otherwise not get it. And so you see a lot of Republicans coming out and saying, you know what, I could get behind the president on this. And so I think Obama senses that there's a true opportunity to have prison reform. And I think another thing that's important is if you saw President Clinton today said in an address that he was wrong during the 1990s, that they treated criminals just too harshly. So I think there's a lot of support across the political spectrum for there to be a deal done so that there is prison reform and that we can help shrink the prison population.
Well, this is something, as you said, that has that bipartisan support. Does the form that the reform takes have any sort of political fault lines in it, or is that pretty much something that's bipartisan as well?
Well, I would say the thing that has to be, you know, what needs to be very carefully done here by the president is that any time, you know, President Obama in these hyper-polarized times that we live in attaches his name to something, it leads to the potential that now all of a sudden Republicans are going to see that and say, you know what, Obama's for it. I don't really want to be for it. So I think he has to be very, very careful in terms of how he presents this. But I don't think that there has been any sort of, you know, where he's like, oh, the states need to do it. There would be support for certainly federal legislation for it to be done. I think President Obama would be wiser, though, to take, you know, more of a hands-off approach, rally his base for sure, but don't try and reach out to too many Republicans. Allow Republicans to talk amongst themselves, and I think then you could get a real formula for success in passing prison reform on the federal level.
So as long as we're talking about President Obama, his favorability rating is up 6 points since last fall. He's now standing at 46%, according to Gallup. What do you attribute that to?
I think that, you know, most of that is attributed to the state of the economy. Although people are still very much not sure about the future, if you look at economic confidence in Gallup going forward, there was a rise going into early winter, and then it sort of leveled off and dropped off. But in terms of where people see their economic state right now, they're pretty confident about it. You see the jobs numbers that come up, they're pretty good. You know, if this now it's like, oh, we only had, you know, 125,000 jobs per month, which it used to be that would be, you know, oh, that would be hailed as good during the height of recession. Now we're seeing that, and that's actually thought of as a bad sign. So, you know, everything is pretty much up, and a president's approval rating generally is tied to the state of the economy. So President Obama is doing well there. And then the other thing I would mention was, you know, he had that he signed the executive action with Dreamers, and so his approval rating among Hispanics has also spiked because of that.
Now, we had big news in Wisconsin this week and nationally when Governor Walker formally announced his bid for president. His speech, people said, it was a red meat speech to the base, and a lot of Ronald Reagan references in there as well. What do you make of his announcement and the platform that seems to be emerging?
This is exactly where he's playing to the base, and he knows that where his strength is. So I went back and I looked at, you know, all the past Republican presidential candidates going back to Ronald Reagan and how voters saw them. And as it turns out, Scott Walker is seen as the most conservative candidate among Republicans since Reagan got nominated in 1980. And that is actually a pretty good thing in this day and age where we're seeing a Republican base that's getting more and more conservative. So Walker knows that if he can play to the conservative base of the Republican Party and cast aside, say, the other frontrunners like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio as these weak moderates, then he's got a real chance to rally the base and be able to put together a winning formula. And he did exactly the same thing in Wisconsin, whereby even though voters saw him as very, very conservative, and he delivered a lot of this red meat, he didn't make statements about rape and stuff like that that we've seen other Republican, national Republicans make over the past few years, sort of these outlandish statements that cost him sort of that moderate vote. But he has this innate ability, it seems, that he's able to capture very conservative voters and make them very happy without seeming too outlandish. He's very conservative, but he's not so conservative as to be seen as unelectable.
And Harry, just very briefly before we let you go, doesn't the nomination usually go to moderates?
The nomination has gone to moderates, but the fact of the matter is I don't believe that Republican voters have been handed a conservative option over the past few cycles that would be seen as being electable. I don't think most Republican voters saw either Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, or going back to 1996, Pat Buchanan as really electable. Scott Walker, though, has won 3 times in 4 years in a purplish-blue state, so he is seen as electable.
Harry, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've been speaking to Harry Enten, senior political writer, analyst for 538. He joins us every week this time to talk national politics.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. It's prime biking season in Wisconsin. The weather is nice, a lot of outdoor festivals around, and after a few beers, you can just pop on your bike and head home. That's the idea, anyway. Wisconsin is one of 29 states with no laws against biking while drunk.
Stephen Elbow joins us now. He's a reporter for the Capital Times. He just wrote a piece about drinking and biking. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, you talked to a lot of people in this piece that prompted our discussion here. In general, is there a sense that, hey, biking, beer culture, they tend to go hand in hand here in Wisconsin?
I think in Wisconsin, and particularly on Madison's east side, where there's brew pubs popping up all the time.
And what kind of people did you talk to for your article to get a sense of the drinking and biking attitudes?
Well, I talked to the happy hour crowd first, but they weren't the hardcore people I was really looking for to lead the story with. So that involved going out a bit later, which, given a 6 o'clock wake up time, was a little bit troublesome. But that's when you find them.
And was the attitude toward drinking and biking maybe more casual than it would be about drinking and driving?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people don't think twice about hopping on their bike when they're pretty sloshed. And, you know, people in general are pretty adamant about not getting behind the wheel.
And you talked to some people in the biking community, some experts, some police people. What was their take? Was their take, hey, maybe it's not as safe as these drinkers and bikers think it is?
Well, the officer I talked to was a veteran bike cop, and so he had some experience with it. He generally thought that it's not the possible repercussions for biking drunk are not as bad as in a car, but at the same time, it's not a victimless crime if you're hit. You know, there's a chance that someone will have to live with your blood on their hands, and you know, he thought there should be some sanctions probably for being too intoxicated on a bicycle.
And as I mentioned and learned from your piece, there's no law against drinking and biking in Wisconsin. There's no blood alcohol level people are going to be looking for as compared to other states, 20 plus other states where it is. How do we stack up in that?
Oh, well, this is Wisconsin, after all, the only state where you can hop behind the wheel and not be charged criminally for your first drunk driving ticket. We generally, I mean, the range is all over the board. I think in Pennsylvania, they will prosecute you as if you were in a car if you're found biking drunk. And then that goes with the license suspension and everything that goes with it. And then in California, it's a misdemeanor, so it's a criminal offense. And then just about everything in between. And then there's the 29 states where there's no real laws against it. But at the same time, if you're doing something really dumb, they will bust you for something else if you're not on, you know, if you're on your bicycle.
Steve, thanks for reporting on this, and thanks for kicking off our conversation today.
No problem.
That's Stephen Elbow, reporter for the Capital Times.
And we're taking your calls on this topic. Do you ever bike after you've had a few drinks? Do you ever bike while you're drunk? Do you think it should be illegal to drink and bike? And how do you think a law against Biking drunk would affect Wisconsin. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now we bring in Dave Cheslevich. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Bike Federation. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again.
Well, we heard about Steve's reporting there. Just from where you're sitting with the Bike Federation, do you get a sense that this is pretty common in Wisconsin, that people are fairly casual about biking while under the influence?
Yeah, I think Steve's article is a good one, raises an important issue. I mean, we have to keep in mind that the vast majority of cyclists, just like the vast majority of drivers, are responsible in how they bike and responsible in their use of alcohol and cycling. But, you know, there always are a few outliers, and Steve's article raises concerns about that.
How dangerous do you think it is to bike after having, say, just that few beers at the brew pub or at the neighborhood festival?
You know, a couple probably is no problem at all. But obviously, the more you drink, the more impaired you're going to become. So I think it's a good idea for folks not to feel that somehow simply because they're biking and not driving that it's okay to drink more than you would if you were getting behind the wheel of a car.
Yeah, that's the attitude that Steve encountered in his piece, that, hey, at least I'm not driving, I'm safer biking. Would you make the case, would the Bike Federation make the case that if you're too drunk to drive a car, you're probably too drunk to be out biking?
As a matter of principle, I think that that is correct. I think that if you imbibed that much, you probably should call a cab.
And we saw a national bicycling group make the case, like, hey, we're looking for bikes to be treated on the roads as vehicles with the respect that entails, with the space on the roadway that entails. So we as operators of those vehicles should try to abide by the same principles as the other vehicles on the road.
Right. Andy Clark from the League of American Bicyclists makes that argument. And I think it's a fair one. I think that if we're going to ask that we be treated equally in terms of our rights on the road, then I think our responsibilities are equal as well.
Talking to Dave Cheslevich from the Wisconsin Bike Federation about drinking and bicycling, prompted by a recent piece in the Capital Times. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you done it? Have you biked and looked back and said, you know what, I was probably too tipsy to have been on that bike? Have you encountered problems like this in your community? And do you think there ought to be a law? 800-642-1234 is the number. Dave, I'll throw that question on you now. Wisconsin has laws on drunk driving, on driving under the influence. Some people say they're too weak. We have no similar laws for bicycling. Do we need that kind of legislation here as 21 other states have?
Well, the Bike Fed doesn't have a position on that. We're a member-driven organization, so if that issue did come up as a serious proposal, we take a look at it with our board of directors and take a formal position at that time. But we certainly don't have any problem saying that, you know, biking while intoxicated is just a bad idea. It's not good for your safety, and it's not good for the safety of others.
What would you think about enforcement of something like that? I mean, we have enough trouble, it seems like, keeping up with vehicle enforcement of drunk driving laws. Bikes, people on bike trails maybe for most of their ride, it seems like it might be difficult to enforce that kind of thing.
I think it probably would be, as it is in other states. But, you know, we've got a broader issue here, of course. You know, Wisconsin leads the nation by a lot of studies in drunk driving. And, you know, we've got a problem with binge drinking overall. Even for folks who don't get behind the wheel or are on a bicycle. So there are broader issues here in society about our relationship with alcohol, particularly in Wisconsin, given some of our heritage. And I think those issues are going to have to be dealt with in the long term. And this is just one manifestation of that.
And I know one of the things you do at the Bike Federation is encourage safe bicycle riding, the helmets, the rules of the road, that sort of thing. Do you worry that those messages maybe get left behind, forgotten, if people are bicycling while under the influence?
Sure. I mean, obviously, if you've had several, your judgment is going to be impaired. You're going to take risks that you wouldn't otherwise. You may not have the same kind of judgment that you would otherwise. And so it's just not advisable. You know, again, if you feel like you're that impaired, the thing to do is just pick up the phone, call a cab.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Joyce on the line in Whitefish Bay. Joyce, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because on behalf of the number of young people especially who go down to some of the taverns and some of the areas, festivals, and do drink, getting out to the suburbs at night, getting a cab is next to impossible. They don't want to come out here. There isn't a return, and it's an alternative. It's better than getting behind a car, and certainly I respect that if you're so inebriated that you're going to cause problems to other people, but I don't think that it's a law that should be out on the books because I see so many young people relying on biking. Biking is a way to still support the festivals, to still be a part of Milwaukee community, and to get home without being behind the wheels of a car.
Joyce, thanks for the call. That reminds me of some people say our drinking and driving problem is in part a planning problem. It's that we've got to get from point A to point B, and we have not set ourselves up in a way to either be able to walk there or have public transit there. Do you think that's maybe the core solution for our drinking and driving and drinking and bicycling problems, Dave?
Well, certainly, you know, we could go out at some length. That could be a whole different show about the way we've designed so many communities in America, to really make them driving everywhere mandatory communities where other forms of transportation are very difficult to use. That's a whole different set of issues. I think it's an issue of just being responsible around alcohol. I mean, it's just not a good idea to be that inebriated and get behind the wheel of a car or get behind or get on a bicycle for that matter. Because there are obvious health issues with that kind of thing. So I think there are underlying issues here that really need to be addressed. And certainly if we had more compact communities, more walkable communities, that would be part of the solution. But I don't think we want communities where people are stumbling around at night because so many of them have had so much to drink.
Joyce, thanks a lot for that call. As we talk to Dave Cheslevich from the Wisconsin Bike Federation, our topic, drinking and bicycling here in Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls. Do you think drunk biking should be illegal in Wisconsin? How closely tied do you think biking and beer culture are in the state? Have you ever biked after having a few drinks, maybe when you felt later like you shouldn't have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Dave Cheslevich from the Wisconsin Bike Federation about biking drunk in Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls. What do you think about drinking and bicycling? It is currently not illegal, no specific law about it. Should it be illegal in Wisconsin, as it is in 21 other states? Make the case for or against that law. And be honest, have you ever done it? Do you think biking and beer culture are related here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Milwaukee. Joe, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you think about this, Joe?
Well, I'll tell you what. I believe here in Wisconsin, or in Milwaukee anyway. I can't say Wisconsin. But a bicycle on the road is treated as a vehicle, as a car. If you run a red light, they can pull you over and give you a ticket, a stop sign. They're doing anything illegal that a car could get stopped for, and it does go against your license. Once a person gets on a bike and he's drunk, adding just that touch, you can pull up in front of somebody, the guy's got to swerve to miss you, hit a pole or something, and the guy's killed. And then what? You know, you just keep on going. You didn't do anything wrong. Certainly you did.
So,
if you did that in a car, you know, you're in trouble.
Joe, all that said, would you want to see a specific law saying, yes, it's illegal if you are pulled over?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
If a bicycle is treated as a vehicle on the roadway, they should be subject to the laws that apply to, a regular car driver.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. And Dave, I know you said the Bike Federation doesn't have a position on whether this should be a law. There's no legislation on the way for you to evaluate yet. But treat bikes and their operators the same way we treat cars and their operators, he's saying.
Right. You know, and that, again, is, you know, that's our position. That's the position of the League of American Bicyclists. And, you know, whether or not there's a law, there's always common sense in play. And we just don't think it's a good idea for people to get on a bicycle and ride if they're drunk. And whether or not there's an official law saying that they shouldn't, the laws of physics always apply. And if you're not able to control your vehicle, whether it's a car or a bicycle, you just shouldn't be on it.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Back to our callers now with John in Lake Haley. John, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, John?
Well, now I work in tavern culture a lot, and I agree that it's bad to be on a bike and drinking, but the basic facts are if you're on a bike drinking, you're more likely to hurt yourself than someone else. So it shouldn't, if it is illegal, it shouldn't be punished the same way as a car. And I do know a number of people that bike to the bars to have a good time, that if they found out that they were going to get punished the same as a car, they'd just as soon drive a car. But they only drive a bike because it's not illegal.
John, thanks for the call. And that's a concern we heard in this piece by Stephen Elbow earlier, Dave Cheslevich. If we made this illegal, if we had a punishment, as John was saying, comparable to operating a vehicle, a car, while intoxicated, people might say, well, if I'm going to get punished either way, forget the bike. I'll just take the car.
Right. If I read Steve's story correctly, states vary widely in the kinds of penalties they apply. And so in some states, actually, the penalty appears to be somewhat less severe than if you're driving. And I would agree with that. If there were a law against drunk bicycling that was enacted, I would hope that the penalties would be a little bit more consistent with the damage that you can do on a car versus a bicycle.
John, thanks a lot for the call. And Dave, I want to ask a question, partly based on your previous job as a city mayor here in Wisconsin. We've talked a lot about drunk driving of cars here in Wisconsin. I'm guessing as a mayor, the police you worked with, they dealt a lot more with drunk driving of automobiles than problems caused by drunk driving on bicycles.
Absolutely. To be perfectly honest with you, this really isn't an issue that at the Bike Tread we've dealt with. I'm happy Steve Elbow wrote the story. I thought it was a good story. I think it's raising an important issue. But frankly, it just isn't one that we have dealt with. We've obviously had issues in the state budget with repeal of complete streets and cuts to programming for cycling. Those have been the issues that have really focused our time and our energy. And so this is something else to consider. But I would say this, you know, related to the other things we were working on, whether you're biking absolutely sober or somewhat impaired, you're always going to be safer on a safer facility. And so the repeal of the complete streets law, the cut of $2 million in funding for bicycle infrastructure projects, that's going to hurt everybody, whether they're drinking or not.
Talking to Dave Cheslevich from the Wisconsin Bike Federation. Our starting point today, biking and drinking, biking while intoxicated, whether you think there ought to be a law, whether you've done this in some cases. 800-642-1234. We've got Ian on the line next in Eau Claire. Ian, hi.
Hi, nice being there.
Yeah, what do you think, Ian?
Well, I'm a college student at the University of Eau Claire. I will admit that not many a time, but a couple times I have indeed ridden my bike back from a party or back from a place that would be a little far to walk, and I would never consider driving. That's the last thing I would do, but I think it is different riding a bike, and one of the big differences is the fact that with bikes, the few times I have done this, it has always been on a secluded trail. Eau Claire is a great biking town. They have incredible trails and safe routes that are far from traffic, and I've always made sure that I'm very visible. I have bright colors on, and I have lights on my bike as well. So if I'm around, I don't encourage it, but I think there should be laws against it. But the fact is that if you're riding on a trail and you're visible and you walk when you are near traffic, if that is a consideration, that is a little bit different of a ball game than just riding your bike drunk on the street or driving a car drunk.
And Ian, I want to ask you, so you've done this, you regret it, you don't recommend it. What in that situation could have been there that maybe gave you another option to where you wouldn't even think about riding your bike in that situation?
I'm not sure a cab and things like that, but being from a less than wealthy college student, it is not easy to be able to call a cab and drop $15 on a night that you didn't plan for being somewhere and you don't have money on you or things like that. And I think what you guys mentioned earlier about planning and things like that is a big thing as far as Wisconsin culture goes. If you're going out drinking, don't have always a secure plan of what's going to happen, especially if it's a college town, you're not sure where you're going to end up, if you're going to go to this place, that place. So there are definitely things in place if there were for larger towns or for college students, if there are things like that, but I don't want to just use the college excuse that I should have rights for free ride and things like that. But that is why I chose to, I felt the most safe situation was to ride my bike at that point.
Ian, thanks a lot for the call. Dave, before we let you go, quick reaction to what Ian had to say.
Well, I think he emphasized my earlier point, which is that he had trails, dedicated bike trails to use, which of course are going to be a lot safer. And again, with the cuts to complete streets and the cuts to funding for those trails, we're not going to see as many of them built as we would have otherwise. So Ian sounds like a responsible guy who did everything he could, even after he was maybe had a couple too many. And so that's, you know, the kind of behavior we'd like to see. But again, we would like to see Ian and others have the opportunity to ride safe trails instead of having to be in a street in any situation, inebriated or not.
Dave, thanks a lot for spending the time with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's Dave Cieslewicz, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Bike Federation, with us to talk about drinking and biking here in Wisconsin. There's been a bacon craze going on for a long time. Just saw some fancy bacon on a stick in a neighborhood block party. State fair's coming up. You'll be able to get bacon wrapped, deep fried, anything you want, probably. Here's one we saw on the internet today, though. It's new to me. Bacon-flavored seaweed. Not bacon mixed with seaweed, but actually a kind of seaweed that naturally tastes like bacon when it's cooked.
So the deal is it came from a project at Oregon State University. They were breeding a strain of dulse, which is an edible red seaweed. Researchers were growing it to feed abalone, which is an edible snail. But humans can eat it too, and the discovery of the bacon flavor has them thinking, hey, maybe this could be a growth industry.
So the obvious question, would we want to eat seaweed that tastes like bacon? I mean, I would try it, certainly. You?
I'm not a huge seaweed fan, and no longer am I a huge bacon fan.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know, but if it were in the sushi form.
Right.
You point out that sushi is
usually raw. But you could,
but
like,
still,
sear it a little bit.
That could be intriguing.
But there's opportunities here, like vegetarians who miss bacon. I don't know what the texture's like. But they, if
probably
they
seaweed-like.
Yeah, if they miss that bacon flavor, if this stuff really does taste like bacon when you cook it, it could. Because I've known bacon-tarians, vegetarians who will still sometimes eat bacon because they miss it so much. This could be their out.
Yeah, that's not a real thing for vegetarians.
Or up next, seaweed-flavored bacon.
There you go.
I'm not sure who that
patent
helps.
It.
Yep, we'll get on that here at the Central Time Labs.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network.